Scientists at the University of Adelaide have made a new discovery about the nature of a subatomic particle, thanks to a field of study called Lattice QCD, which uses supercomputers to process immense data to discover more about the minute elements of our universe. Derek Lineweber is a professor of physics at the Department of Physics at the University of Adelaide. He's a member of the team that made the discovery. I asked him to start our conversation by explaining to me how people get involved in studying quantum physics and to explain a bit about his specialisation, quantum chromodynamics.
It does start off with quantum mechanics, something that we're introduced to, I guess, as early as first year undergraduate physics. And then we start to get into it, I guess, in third year would be our first chance to see the full interesting aspects of quantum physics and how strange the world is at short distances. But then it's at the honors level that we start talking about quantum field theory. And that's where it gets really interesting. It's complicated, but it's fascinating.
What's your story on having come to your research? How did you get there?
I thought I was interested in computer science. And in fact, when I was enrolling in university, I'd applied to go into a computer science degree. I'd also had a high school project that went to the Canada-wide Science Fair, and I met some physicists there. And they liked what I was doing and twisted my arm to come into physics. And I thought, okay, I'll go into physics for a couple of years and then I'll get back into computer science. And I found out that actually it was physics that I wanted to do. I wanted to solve scientific problems with computers. But I didn't understand that coming out of high school. I think very often we ask students to choose a career path where they don't really have an idea of all the options out there and what it's really all about. So into physics, undergraduate degree, then I did a master's degree and a PhD at McMaster University in Canada. Then in my first postdoc is when I started doing what we call Lattice QCD, which is that merging of physics concepts and computer science.
And how did you come to be working in Adelaide?
After you do your PhD, you do a number of positions called postdoctoral positions. And I held a position at Triumph at the University of British Columbia. Then I went to the University of Maryland in College Park. Then off to the Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. My last postdoc was at the University of Washington in Seattle. And so I had a good look around there, but it was there that I met Tony Thomas and Tony Williams from the University of Adelaide. And fortunately, at that time, they had just won a special research center for the subatomic structure of matter here, which meant they were one of the few places in the world that had a position. And I was the lucky guy that got it.
You're talking about QCD, which is lattice imagery using a supercomputer. Is that what it does?
QCD is a theory that describes how the most fundamental particles that make up the proton and neutron that sit at the heart of the atom in the nucleus. QCD, quantum chromodynamics, describes how quarks and gluons interact and make up things like the proton and the neutron.
Let's step back a step. Quarks and gluons are what people thought were the nothing within those particles, is that right?
Yeah, I guess at one point they thought that the proton and the neutron were indeed elementary. And it was through scattering experiments, very high energy scattering experiments, that one could infer the existence of smaller particles. At very high energies, they appeared almost free, which was quite surprising. But as they explore larger and larger distances, the interactions become stronger. And in fact, those interactions are so strong that we've never seen an isolated quark. They always come with a partner, maybe an anti-quark, or they come with two other quarks. We like to think of them as carrying color. And it turns out that all particles that we do see in experimental detectors are colorless. So there's a couple ways you can get colorless. One is to have a color and it's anti-color. So you can have pairs of quarks and anti-quarks, and we call those mesons. That's quite important for the research we've been doing recently. And the other way you can get a colorless object is to have one of each color, so that when you add them all together, you end up with a colorless object. And so the way we think of that is having three quarks.
With the concept of the meson, it's the quark and the antiquark essentially cancel each other out to create colorless.
As far as the color goes, yes, yes. But the quarks, they also come in flavors. Yeah, it's a good metaphor. So there are six flavors of quarks, and three of them are very important to the things that we're dealing with on a regular basis. In fact, two of them, I guess, make up most of the observable matter in the universe, and that would be an up quark and a down quark. And as I said, you need three of them to make a colorless object. So protons are made out of three quarks, as are neutrons. And if you pair them up in different ways, so proton would have two U quarks and a D quark, and that makes it a charge plus one. And neutron has two down quarks and an up quark. Now, a long time ago, they figured out the electric charges for these so that it adds up to one and zero. And if you haven't figured it out doing the math in your head, it's U quarks have charge two-thirds, and the down quark has charge minus a third. And that's in the magnitude of the electron charge.
You said that quarks exist in pairs, but now you're speaking about trios. Or does it just mean they never live alone?
Oh, absolutely. You can't have just one alone. If you were to reach into a proton and grab onto one of its three quarks and try to pull it out, you would encounter an enormous amount of energy in the process of pulling it out. The force is actually constant, but as you continue to pull, you build up more and more energy in that system. So much so that you can actually create a brand new quark-antiquark pair that didn't exist before. And now instead of having three quarks, you'd have five, three of them in the proton and a quark-antiquark pair in a meson. So, yeah, they're confined in an odd way.
It's quite amazing. And I think I read something about that the channel between the quarks is probably the only place in which a true vacuum exists, where there is actually nothing there. Is that correct?
Yeah, it turns out, it's hard to believe, but empty space, and you know, as we look around the room, we're pretty sure that there's nothing but the air in here. But if you were to go out into deep outer space and ask, is the vacuum empty? In a quantum field theory sense, the answer is no. There are quark and gluon field fluctuations everywhere. And we know they're there because of the way that the quarks we're talking about, the, say, U and D quarks of the proton. If you were to ask what's their mass, they're very, very light. And the only way you can turn that tiny little mass of the quarks into the mass of the proton is to have them interacting with this background field that exists in empty space. Now, they do tend to clear out that vacuum a little bit in between them. We call those flux tubes. But the most important physics is that these light quarks are interacting with quark and gluon field fluctuations that do exist even in the remotest parts of outer space.
You've recently had quite an exciting discovery in your research group that a subatomic particle is actually a special type of quark. Can you explain about the lambda particle?
Yeah, we've been very interested in the lambda 1405. It's an excited state of a particle we call a lambda. So maybe I should just back up a bit. We're used to thinking about protons and neutrons. But just as we're comfortable with the idea that atoms can have excited states, where you take an electron and put it into an excited orbital, and when it falls down, it emits light. So we're used to actually making lights out of that quantum physics. The same kind of thing happens for things like protons and neutrons. You can take one of those quarks and put it into an excited state. And the lambda is a particularly interesting particle. It's very much like a neutron, in that its simplest quark structure would be to have three quarks, whereas the neutron has two down quarks and an up quark. The lambda has one down, one up, and one strange quark. So it's a little bit different, but nevertheless, very much like a neutron, it has zero charge. And just as a neutron can have an excited state, the lambda can have an excited state. And the one that we're interested in is the 1405. And we call it that based on the energy that that state has. Now, it turns out that's an interesting state because its energy is very, very low. It's completely unexpected. When they discovered it back in the early 60s, it was thought that perhaps it's not a regular three-quark state like the proton or neutron, but might be some sort of exotic molecular state where you take a meson and you take something like a nucleon, and you bind them together into a molecular state. So we've been investigating that. In fact, people have been investigating that possibility for 50 years. We finally have an answer to whether these molecular bound states exist or if the lambda 1405 is a regular three-quark state. That's what we're excited about.
And what did you find?
We found that it is, in fact, a molecular bound state of a meson and a nucleon. It was quite surprising. I have to say I was somewhat skeptical, and many people were skeptical over the years. I think what made us skeptical is that just about every other particle we look at that can be described with a simple three-quark model, in fact, that works very well. And in fact, I did my PhD work on this very particle, and at that time, with what we were able to do, it looked every bit as elementary as a normal neutron. So it was through doing lattice QCD calculations that we were able to answer this question. And lattice QCD is special in that it's a systematic approach that allows us to do calculations of this wonderful theory, quantum chromodynamics, and do it in a way in which all of the uncertainties associated with the calculation are systematically controlled. In other words, it's the only way that you can do a calculation and actually find out what the real quantum field theory is predicting. And I guess that's what's caused 50 years of debate. This hasn't been possible before, and so people have made models of QCD. But that always leaves open questions of, oh, is your model really a true approximation of what nature's doing? So that's why we're excited. It's the first time we've actually been able to calculate what this theory is predicting.
And what runs the QCD? Is that a supercomputer? Is that how you are able to process all of this? It must be a massive amount of data that you have to process to look at this.
It is a massive amount of data. The very first step in doing a lattice QCD calculation is to make typical snapshots of empty space, which aren't empty. And so it actually takes quite a bit of computer time. There are major groups around the world that invest enormous amounts of supercomputing time into this calculation, and we're very fortunate to benefit from a Japanese collaboration called the PAC-CS collaboration, who have done a very impressive calculation of empty space and very graciously made all of their configurations available to people around the world so we can do world-class calculations. So we build on that. The next step is to calculate how quarks move around in these typical snapshots of empty space. And we do that on supercomputers. We use the NCI National Facility at ANU, and we draw on the PASI Supercomputing Center out in Western Australia. And very important, we draw on GPU clusters. These are graphics processing unit clusters where we write special code to use the graphics processors to do supercomputing. And we do that here at the University of Adelaide. That technology is very important for Australian scientists because supercomputers are expensive, but graphics processing units, they're relatively cheap. And so we do very well by drawing on the GPU technology.
And that's what allows you to then create that visualization that I've seen online, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. After we tie the quarks together, we can then start probing, you know, what's the mass of the state. And for our research, it was particularly important to learn how the quarks are distributed within this lambda 1405 particle, and especially how each of the quarks in the lambda 1405 give rise to magnetism. And that was really the secret for us being able to, you know, say with certainty that this thing had formed a molecular bound state.
I found it fascinating that you can take a snapshot of nothing. Is the basis of all of that mathematical?
No, that's a very good question. How on earth do we do it?
Yeah, that's the right question. How on earth do you do it?
So we lay down a grid. We call it lattice QCD because of the lattice. We lay down a grid of points. I guess if we think of it as a checkerboard, you can imagine labeling each of the squares. And then we simulate what the theory is doing on each of the points on the lattice. So for lattice QCD, we actually have a four-dimensional lattice. It's the usual three spatial dimensions plus a time dimension. And we actually start with assuming that there are no fields there. We call this a cold start. And then you suggest a new field value at the first point on the lattice. And you do a calculation with the QCD equations that govern the theory. And they tell you whether that suggestion is probable or not. And if it's probable, you keep it. And if it's not, then you throw it away. And you work your way through all the sites on the lattice, and you do this several hundreds of thousands of times over, and then you save one configuration, and then you do a whole bunch more sweeps through the lattice and save another configuration. And the idea is that by constantly proposing new field values as you go through, eventually you build up with typical snapshots of what the QCD fields are doing in the vacuum.
Do quarks follow the same pattern over and over again within a proton or within a lambda particle, for example?
So the quarks strongly interact with these field configurations of empty space. One of the things that we like to do with a typical configuration is plot up its energy density. And you can visualize that in three dimensions by, say, picking a particular time slice, and then you can plot up the energy density of those field fluctuations. And it's a lumpy structure, and in fact, we can make contact with low-energy ideas of what it should look like, and in fact, we do see that. But what we've discovered is that the most probable place to find a quark within one of those field configurations is on top of those lumps. And so these lumps persist for a short period of time. They come and go, and so they'll sit on one lump for a brief period in time, but as it disappears, it'll find another one, and it will hop around within the vacuum in this way. And that really governs the long-distance behaviors of the quarks. And all quarks will behave the same way. It's not until you tie them together with partners to make the particles we're talking about, like three quarks tied together to make a neutron, or three or more quarks tied together to make the lambda 1405.
For anyone listening, the visualization almost looks like a boiling sugar. It's kind of like it's got bubbles that come up and pop and disappear all the time.
Some people think it looks a little bit like a lava lamp.
Yeah.
But I've always pointed out it's actually better than a lava lamp. Because in lava lamps, the little lumps form and they slide around inside the liquid. But with the QCD lava lamp, the little balls that you see floating around, they come out of nowhere. You'll have nothing there, and then all of a sudden a little seed will grow, and then it'll get big and move around in some sort of interesting way and then disappear again. So, yeah, kind of fun.
Yeah, it looks amazing. What are the broader implications for all of these discoveries? Where do they connect, or do they?
No, they do. And I think this is what we're so excited about with our discovery is that, yes, we focused on a particular particle that looked unusual. I guess that's why we're studying it. It was considered exotic. It might reveal something interesting. And having calculated how quarks are distributed within this lambda 1405, we've now discovered that nature does like to have a meson and a nucleon come together and form a bound state. People speculated this might happen for a long time, but now we actually know nature does this, and that's really cool. That's the new insight. And so the very first thing that comes to your mind is, okay, where else should we look? Where else can we find some meson nucleon bound states? And we do have very good candidates. There's another exotic, well, almost as exotic as the lambda 1405. It's called the Roper resonance of the nucleon. So it's sort of like an excited state of the neutron. Some people just say it's a high-energy version of the neutron, for example. And we've been trying to make this particular state on the lattice, and we're having a very rough time. We've got operators that have the right properties, but when we act on this empty vacuum and try to create this excited state, we seem to miss it, and we get even higher excited states. So in our theoretical calculations, there's actually a gap we're missing. A state. And so the next step is, aha, it's because our operators we're using to try and create it aren't the right ones, and we need to make meson baryon type operators in order to create this. So that's the next step.
And so you'll start upon that line of inquiry now and
absolutely
hope that turns something up.
It should work. Yeah, it'd be fun.
We were talking before about how people come through school and they find it hard to find out what direction they're going to go in and really contextualize, for example, computer science versus physics, finding that direction and understanding what it really is that they're fascinated by and is going to give them that ongoing challenge. With this particular area of quantum field theory, how can people make it tangible to them and go, no, that's the direction I want to go because that's really compelling? What would you say?
I guess my advice is try lots of things and discover what you like and follow that. If you're working on things that you enjoy, if you're doing the things you like, it's easy. I mean, the problems might be hard, but it'll be easy to find the energy to work on those problems. And that's what it's all about. The most interesting problems to solve in science are hard. And if you're fascinated by it, you'll find the energy and you'll put the time in and given time. You're very likely going to be successful. So it's really a matter of finding out what you like. And I think there, you can't really know until you've given it a try. So if you have an opportunity, take a wide variety of courses. Have a taste of what's out there. The things you like, take on more. for me, it's interesting that I did end up working with supercomputers, which is what I knew I wanted to do, but I didn't have a clue of what the path was to get there. And it was really just by being happy to give physics a try for a year or two that I discovered, oh, wait a minute, this is actually what I want to do. So yeah, find out what's out there and follow what you like.
In your research around the Lambda 1405 subatomic particle, you obviously did that with a team. Who did you work with on that?
The team that we have at this point in time is absolutely vital to getting this result out. It's really a matter of some incredibly bright PhD students and recent PhD graduates doing research with us that's made it possible for us to bring many different directions of approaching this problem together. I would like to mention Ben Menadou, who's a PhD candidate who's writing up his thesis at this point in time, and this discovery will be an important part of his thesis. And Ben Owen is another PhD candidate who's been absolutely critical to moving this work forward. I should also mention Jonathan Hall, who's led the effective field theory side of this calculation. Jonathan's a recent PhD graduate and did a research associate with us and is actually now doing research with the IPAS, with the Institute for Photonics and Advanced Sensing. So it's nice to see him branching out into brand new areas. I should also mention the senior people, Wasim Kamley, who's absolutely key to the foundation of all of our lattice QCD codes, and then Ross Young and Tony Thomas, who are also absolute gurus on effective field theory. So it's really by having this team of people together at this point in time that everything came together and allowed us to make this discovery so strong.
What's the response been from the broader scientific community for you having made this discovery?
I guess the first thing that happens is those that knew it was a molecule all along are writing now and saying, oh, this is wonderful. You finally proved that we were right so many years ago, which is great. Yeah.
You work so hard on very big theories and trying to get that proof that people can hinge it on. There must be so much speculation and it must be such a joy.
Well, it is. And that's the history of the field is a lot of speculation, because it's only recent that we've been able to do the first principles calculation of this quantum field theory and discover what its predictions are. In the past, it's been QCD-inspired models that we've been learning from. But now we get to do the real thing. It's great.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully we'll get to talk to you about your next big discovery.
Oh, we're looking for the Roper.
When you found the Roper, talk to you again.
Okay, give us a few months.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for your time.
Well, it's been great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Derek Leinweber, Professor of Physics at the University of Adelaide.